We're going to continue with carboxylic acids today, which, since you still don't have your formal syllabus up, let me tell you. Oh, is that my pen? Anybody got a black pen?
You know, it was Friday the 13th. Now this is Monday. You know. Go ahead. One, a few times you can throw something at an instructor. There you go. Oh, then I also get this rain of pens coming from the audience.
Chapters 17 and 18, I believe, are the ones you're going to care about, because those are the chapters that, although they do mix aldehydes and ketones in with the different carboxylic acid derivatives, that they do actually talk about the different carboxylic acid derivatives. We have so far talked about a cationic reaction mechanism, that's Fischer esterification. We've talked about an anionic mechanism, that is saponification. We also talked about how the fact that carboxylic acids are acidic, you know, all the other carboxylic acid derivatives don't have easily removable protons. But because carboxylic acids do have that ability to be deprotonated, that changes their reactivity. And so although there may be many cases where we have both an anionic and cationic mechanism available for reaction, we might not have it where carboxylic acids are involved. And that's where, for example, saponification comes in. You can saponify an ester. You cannot make an ester using a base out of a carboxylic acid, with one exception. Which, what was the reaction that we saw that was the exception? Diazomethane, wasn't it, to make a methyl ester? We did that in this section, didn't we? Okay, so don't forget that reaction, because obviously that means it's going to come up again. Oh, I did leave you over the weekend, though, with a couple of questions that wraps up some little details related to these first few reactions we did. And one of them was, if we took a carboxylic acid and reacted it with an excess of isotopically labeled water with some kind of acid source and heat, what would result? And based on your careful reading of the lecture text, Muhammad, what would you say would be the answer? No, is your name Muhammad?
Yes.
Well, okay, what's the mechanism that's going to be in place here? Let's just start there. What's it going to look like? Or what other thing did we discuss like last week that this would be the most similar to?
So the carbonyl oxygen is going to get coordinated.
Okay, yes.
And water is going to attack.
And water will attack in. So that's like the Fischer esterification or de-esterification. This is different only that we are starting with something that's already carboxylic acid, and we're only using water, so we're not making an ester, but it's the same mechanism. If you let that mechanism keep going on, then eventually, what's going to happen? Eventually, every time that water attacks, it's going to be the isotopically labeled water. Every time that process of opening the carbonyl and it collapsing again, it would be water attacking. The point of this mechanism, though, is that if you didn't go through the process where it opened first, if you had more like an SN2-style attack, then it would only be this regular hydroxide group that would be kicked out each time. Since I'm saying too much sort of nebulously, let me write this down. That if, even in the basic version, somehow, which we don't have that, but if we had, let's say, an ester, let's keep it with the same example. If we had regular carboxylic acid and we did some reaction with just one equivalent of the oxygen 18 derivative, if there was no opening of the carbonyl and it was just a SN2 style reaction, we might imagine that this is the only product. And no matter how many times this reaction occurred, if the carbonyl didn't get involved, you could only replace one of these oxygens with O18. The point of this reaction is that with a large excess, you're going to get both oxygens labeled because the carbonyl bond does open. And so you do have the chance for any of the three oxygens in that intermediate that forms to react. And that's the whole point. Your book has section 17 point whatever. I forget exactly what section. But it actually does the reverse situation where it starts with a normal, or no, it starts with an oxygen 18 labeled carboxylic acid, and it hydrates it, I believe. But the same kind of logic. If the carbonyl oxygen never got involved, the carbonyl, if it were labeled with O18, would permanently stay labeled. It didn't, which proved that a tetrahedral intermediate is involved. Which you might remember when I was showing you mechanism last week, there was my own internal discussion about whether reactions should be written as multiple steps occurring separately or whether you can write multiple steps together. And for carboxylic acid mechanisms, this whole thing is leading up to is that when we write something like saponification, that the point is that first step where sodium hydroxide would attack, it does push the carbonyl open, is the point. And then there's a second step where whatever that's going to get kicked out, which if this is saponification, we hope that it's the alkoxide that gets kicked out at this point. But that's going to happen separately. So whichever way you want to express it, the results of this oxygen 18 example indicate that carboxylates do go through tetrahedral intermediates. And so the above steps during saponification, and this is just an example, must be shown separately. Now, there was another similar question I asked, wasn't there? And I don't remember the exact way I asked it, but here's the point of the question, is if I had an ethyl ester and I reacted it with a large excess of propanol with an acid source in a long time, what will happen? Oh, that's right, I have to name someone. Jessica, what do you think would happen? And if you're not sure, use your best educated guess. What do the conditions look like? Like, ignore the fact that I'm starting with an ester. What do the reaction conditions look like? They're acidic conditions, and these are actually the same conditions as Fischer esterification, aren't they? So the question is, in Fischer esterification conditions, what happens to something that's already an ester? The answer is it reacts. If you have a large excess of this alcohol, you will kick out the original alcohol and end up with the longer one there. This is a process known as transesterification. It does not mean trans as in cis-trans. It means transfer, you could say. You change the type of ester. another place where this comes up very commonly. Let's say that we have this kind of situation. What reactions could happen? SN2, where? With the bromide, correct? Primary alkyl halide, strong basic nucleophile, SN2 reaction. What else unwanted is going to happen? You could get this instead. Why? Easy. What if, instead of attacking the bromine, it attacks the carbonyl? You end up with this tetrahedral intermediate that I just discussed. And you'll have two different alcohols that are also attached. Which one's going to get kicked out? Well, it depends on how much ethoxide you have around and how much time you give it. But there's no real big difference between the stability of ethoxide versus methoxide. So there's no reason that methoxide could not be kicked out, which means you've changed the ester. And in this very, very, very specific example, didn't even do the SN2 you expected to do. Even if you had thrown enough ethoxide in to make sure you did the SN2, you'd be guaranteeing that transesterification would occur. That's also one of these consequences of these types of mechanisms that's reversible. And remember that for esterification or saponification, the actual attack of the carbonyl is reversible because the basicity of what you start with and end with is so similar. So there's the two questions that I had over the weekend. What would happen with O18 and what would happen with an excess of alcohol? In both cases, the answer is, well, reaction occurs. In the case of O18, that's used to demonstrate that we do have these tetrahedral intermediates, which if you're a little confused by those still, let me ask this question. How many of you, without having to see the syllabus, worried enough that you figured out your own selves which chapter that we're really talking about right now? Because if you had actually opened up the textbook to find out, it wasn't that hard to determine, was it? And I know it's scary going to a class where your instructor hasn't even told you what chapter we're in. But it's very obvious if you'd opened the book. How many of you tried, though? Only one set of notes got posted up on the weekend or before the weekend or during the weekend or any point. How many people have listened to or downloaded that first set of notes? I'm not seeing very many hands go up. So even though I've warned you or cautioned you that this is the easier of the three quarters, didn't I also say that this first week or two would be nasty because of the number of reactions that we're going to learn? So has that changed? No. So, and the two questions that, regardless of what else, you knew I was still going to ask, and I hadn't forgot about that third one. Did anybody find that oddball functional group? That one I would not be surprised if you were unable to, because with what I had at home, I didn't find the name of that group either. Yes?
Just a question on that.
Yes. Oh, but you can't interrupt my lecturing them of not wanting to fall behind, which... You know, there's the do as you say, not as you do. So, yeah, I'm behind, but I'm also not the one getting a grade right now, am I? So I'm just worried about the fact that people had difficulty answering the questions they knew were going to be asked, let alone just study the stuff that's in their best interest to. Are we done with the soapbox lecture now? Are we going to study? You don't want to get out of here with a bad grade in 12C just because you got to the end and then stopped before you made it to the end, right? Yeah, don't get senioritis in your sophomore year. Anyways, now your question, because I'm done with this.
Is there a preference towards sodium ethoxide attacks? Would you prefer to do an SN2 for the bromine? Or
I don't know which would be the more likely of the two, given a one chance shot at reaction, but that's actually not the worry. The worry is that regardless, you're going to have transesterification. So we addressed transesterification, so that takes care of that. We did the tetrahedral immediate. So now we have all the different functional groups we're going to start playing with. Yes?
So in terms of that, it doesn't matter what else you have, as long as it's not attached to
the
everything else, it won't
really
react to that?
No. So let me address this bottom example. I did make you all think for a minute about what the significance is of having two reactable functional groups and only one reagent. But that is not my main concern about showing that example. My example is more to say, even if what you thought was going to happen, SN2, even if that happened, if you had excess reagent around, the more important point is you're not going to end up with the ester that you thought you did. So pretend it's some other reaction that I wanted to have there, not even SN2. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about the fact that you don't keep the ester that you expect to. So I'm not going to ask you, will SN2 happen or not? I'm not going to ask you which will happen first. I'm not going to ask you what's the product distribution. I'm going to have some question that I'm going to design that's going to have exactly this, an inappropriately chosen base given the reaction that wants to happen. See, if I put methoxide here, you wouldn't know if methoxide attacked the methyl ester because it would just make a methyl ester. And we wouldn't even have this discussion. You'd see SN2 there and you'd think, oh, everything's fine. Because the base was compatible with the ester that you had there. So the better way of saying it is that the reaction in principle is not bad, but I'm going to get byproducts if I'm not aware that transesterification is possible. Does that make sense? Yes. But did I not answer the question you really had?
No,
I didn't. Let's say it again, because... Transesterification happens all the time. Even with the same, like this. I just wrote product A comes from reactant A, that nothing appears to happen. But there may be billions of times that that carbonyl got open and closed. You just don't know it because you didn't see any change in the product. So the answer is yes, there'll always be a reaction. There's a reaction that occurs here, and you'd know it if, again, you had an isotopic label. Then you might see that show up here. Was that more the question you wanted answered?
Yeah.
Okay. Does anybody have any other questions about this topic? Okay, then here's where we're going next. How to move between the different carboxylic acid derivatives. And yes, I know your textbook says that esters are more reactive than carboxylic acids. And so I'm trying to go into some other OCHEM text and find out what the quote-unquote real answer is. Because it wasn't the way I was originally taught, and maybe it's not wrong. Maybe the difference in reactivity is 94.5 versus 94.6. You know, maybe they're that close that in the past where they were normally lumped together and said they're roughly the same. Now there's some distinction. Not worrying about that at the moment, let's worry about converting between the different groups. Because if I start out with a carboxylic acid, and let's say I can't do Fischer esterification because I have some other acid-sensitive functional group on there, then how could I esterify? First, let's just do a double check to make sure everybody knows that if I did have methanol and an acid source and heat, that one of the likely products of this reaction, besides the one you want, is for the alkene to be substituted. Well, if we don't want the alkene to be substituted, do we have another way of making an ester? The answer is yes. And one of the ways you learned part of last quarter. Thionyl chloride. What does thionyl chloride do? But what does it do? Turns an alcohol into an acyl halide, does it not? Turns a carboxylic acid. No, I said acyl halide. Should have said alkyl halide. But it turns a carboxylic acid into an acyl halide. And it has a somewhat similar mechanism. Attack the sulfur oxygen double bond. That sulfur oxygen bond can reform, kicking off one of the chlorines is a leaving group. We lose a proton off of the oxygen, get something neutral. And the carbonyl can get attacked by chloride, which in this case works only because this sulfur-containing group is such an excellent leaving group. So in other words, when chloride attacks, afterwards, when the carbonyl's reformed, instead of chloride just getting kicked right back out again, it's this sulfur group. And part of the reason for that is that a lone pair doesn't just fall back to oxygen. It actually falls back, attacks the sulfur, and kicks chloride out. So we've made an acyl halide, plus we have sulfur dioxide that bubbles out as a gas. You do need to know that last step where the sulfur group decomposes, because again, that's part of the driving force for it being such a good leaving group. Now that we've made an acyl halide, didn't we identify that as the most reactive of all functional groups in that carboxylic acid series? So, I can make anything less reactive than it. How? Well, if I wanted to make an ester, what kind of reagents could I use? Do I have a choice about whether I use acidic or basic conditions? Think about the reaction mechanisms we had. Fissure esterification would be an example of acidic conditions. Could we use those acidic conditions on this molecule? Why not? Yes, I'm sorry, I'm not looking at the alkene. So, good. Although, I'm going to bet that in this case, we might be able to get away with it. But let me wrap up this example and switch to something that doesn't have the alkene so that we don't have to worry about that. We don't even need an acid. All we need is the alcohol. This reagent is a reactive enough functional group that it will appear to undergo an anionic mechanism where it's not an anion, it's a neutral alcohol. But the neutral alcohol could attack that carbonyl by itself. If in the general case, so now I'm going to switch out of talking about the sneaky case with the alkene. But in a general case, if I had an acyl halide, the most reactive thing I could do is to throw an actual alkoxide at it. That will also go by an anionic mechanism that will look like saponification, therefore. I'm not going to write a reaction mechanism for every single one of these combinations, but I will go ahead to make sure there's no confusion, write representative ones. So in this example, the alkoxide attacks and kicks open the carbonyl. Again, that's just like saponification. Also just like in saponification, once we have this tetrahedral intermediate, the carbonyl is going to reform and something gets kicked out as a response. Well, we have an alkoxide, which is the parent of an alcohol that has what kind of pKa? Primary alcohol like ethanol has what kind of pKa value to it? 16, there we go. Versus chloride, which is the conjugate of an acid that's got a negative pKa because it's such a good acid. So out of the two of these, it's only going to be the chloride that's likely to get kicked out. And that is the second step of one of these anionic mechanisms for that thing to become kicked out again. I could, in theory, if I made rigorously sure that I had no water around, in theory, you could have acidic conditions. And you would get the exact same product. But this would be the more cationic style mechanism. So which one in real life should you do or would you do? Normally it's just even with the plain alcohol that it's done because the acyl halide is reactive enough. If you had easy access to it, the alkoxide, that would guarantee a vigorous reaction, but that usually means an extra step to make the alkoxide. And that's why normally the alcohol is used. Normally this last method wouldn't be used in case that you introduced water into the system, because water would make a carboxylic acid out of the acyl halide instead of an ester. So we've learned how to take a carboxylic acid into an acyl halide, that's thionyl chloride, and we've learned how to convert it back into, well, so far we've only seen a ester. Of course, if we had water or hydroxide, that would get a carboxylic acid. What if we wanted an amide? What's an amide? What's an amide? Do we not know? How many people have memorized the main carboxylic acid derivatives, which is acyl halide, anhydride, carboxylic acid, ester, amide, imide, nitrile? How many of you worked on your PKA values? How many of you started studying stereochem? Is there any point of me giving any of these warnings or help advice to any of you all if none of you are going to do anything with it? Wow, really? Ooh, not a way to impress your instructor. Ooh. Hmm? I know it's transferitis, but it's deadly. You don't want to catch it in O-chem. My goodness. An amide is when you have a nitrogen instead of an oxygen where the ester oxygen would be. In other words, if I took an acyl halide and reacted it with a primary amine, it's already basic. You don't need an acid catalyst. It is basic. It will attack the carbonyl. It'll be an anionic style mechanism, and you'll end up with an amide. That right there that I just wrote is an amide. Since I'm harping on you about functional groups, why don't I just throw two more new ones in there? Since I guess having seven wasn't enough of a challenge. So, Marvin, don't answer this question. What is that? Oh, wow. Did you know that or read that? Or it's in the book. That's the best answer possible. Lactone, which I presume has some relationship to milk. I don't know how that term got derived. Sugars form something that looks something like that, kind of, sort of, not really, but that's the only reason I can think where that lact come from. Even stranger, and again, don't know the derivation of the term, Gesundheit, is this lactam. Which are nothing more than a cyclic ester and a cyclic amide. But the fact that you cyclize will cause one of these functional groups to have differing reactivity from its linear counterpart when we start doing reduction reactions, which looks like I won't be able to start today, but we'll definitely get to on Wednesday. So you do need to know these two functional groups. I'm warning you now, these cyclic functional groups will show up in one mechanism and one synthesis problem somewhere on the first exam. So I think we've done acyl halides to death, other than what will happen in reduction and what will happen in Grignard reactions. Those are the two biggies that I'm going to address last, so we can do all the functional groups at the same time. So are there any questions about acyl halides? Because you've seen what happens when water reacts with it, which that's hydrolysis. You've seen what happens when alcohol reacts with it, that's solvolysis. And you've seen what happens when an amine reacts which is technically aminolysis. Would you like me to write those three terms down, since I don't think I've properly defined them yet this quarter? There's hydrolysis, reaction with water. Solvolysis, which is usually a term used when you react with an alcohol. And then there's aminolysis, which is a reaction with an amine. So let's move to the next functional group. Anhydrides, which are one of the less useful functional groups. And there's a good practical reason why. First of all, how to make an anhydride. One reagent that's sometimes used is phosphorus pentoxide. The reason it's used is because it's really, really hygroscopic. Hygroscopic enough that with heat and a carboxylic acid, it'll pull the water out of two carboxylic acids and make them an anhydride. There's also a trick which I'm not going to write down, but I'll tell the story because for the few chem majors we got in here, you should know this story. acetyl chloride, or actually acetic anhydride itself, this compound I just made, which, let me write that name down because this is the itty-bitty tiny bit of nomenclature we're going to do with this functional group. If you have an acid, like acetic acid, then to name its anhydride, you just stick the word anhydride in instead of acid. So methanoic anhydride would be an anhydride containing carboxylic acids that have how many carbons?
One.
Okay, good. So acetic anhydride. When acetic anhydride decomposes, it makes acetic acid. Acetic acid is a relatively low boiling point compound. So if you have a large chain, I said I wouldn't write it down, but I lied. When you have a large chain carboxylic acid, if you distill at the same time that you react, so that you pull the acetic acid out that forms, as it forms, then you can use one anhydride to dehydrate another. But anhydrides outside of this are not always useful. Why? Because you can have the possibility of making mixed anhydrides. If you had two different carboxylic acids, how could you reproducibly dehydrate one versus the other? And the short answer is you can't. You can synthesize a mixed anhydride, though. How? For example, if I gave you this synthesis problem, how would you accomplish it? Well, what's more reactive than an anhydride? Acyl halide. So what if we took one of the carboxylic acids, made it into the acyl halide? Separately, we took the other carboxylic acid and deprotonated it. Which, I can't remember if I wrote this name down on Friday because I was in such a hurry to get through the material. Carboxylate salt. One of the hidden carboxylic acid derivatives, because it's just the conjugate base of an acid. But you should know that carboxylic goes to carboxylate. So carboxylate salt. Salt is basic, is a nucleophile. Put it together with the acyl halide, you get a mixed anhydride. But since it takes effort to make the anhydride, and we have the more easily formable acyl halide, generally if we wanted to do something with an anhydride, we try to do it with an acyl halide instead. So in fact, I'm not going to show you any more reactions of an anhydride other than to at least show you once that it functions like an acyl halide. So if we took acetic anhydride, react it with an alcohol, it's still reactive enough to react with a neutral alcohol, so it'd be an anionic style mechanism in order to make an ester. How's everybody doing with that? We've got acyl halides and anhydrides out of the way, and you didn't have to learn too many reactions or mechanisms to do it. New ones, at least. Of course, we got a page full of reactions here, but let me pull that previous page down and show you. It's just the same kind of mechanism as saponification or esterification anyways. So we've not learned other than thionyl chloride, which we learned last quarter. We haven't learned anything new today. Just representation of new things you could do with old reactions. Let's now change a little bit, because the next functional group I would talk about is esters, but we already talked about esters. We learned how to saponify them. I guess I should go back, though, and show you that on top of basic saponification, and even though I wrote the reaction mechanism, I guess, I want to highlight that you could use water, acid, and heat to cause an ester to decompose again. And we did do that mechanism, didn't we, on Friday? Okay. So where does that leave us functional group-wise? Well, amides and nitriles. So let's talk about amide first. Amides, we already have learned, are the least reactive of the carboxylic acid functional groups. And that's because the nitrogen so heavily is delocalized with the carbonyl next door. This, I already commented, was a good thing since proteins are made up of these kinds of linkages. The process of cooking is partly to cause proteins, if not completely to separate, to lose some of their chemical behavior, to denature them, you could say, to make them less harmful once we consume them. But there is a way to totally blast an amide apart, which is to either do hydrolysis or saponification. We have both an acid and a base method available. Now, amides are less reactive than carboxylic acids and any of those higher derivatives. So we're never going to take an amide and go directly to an acyl halide, for example. So once we learn these simple reactions of amides, then we still have just the Grignard reaction and reduction reaction coming. Have I said the words Grignard and reduction enough that when you go, hopefully you've been guilt-tripped a little bit into looking at the textbook today? So when you look at chapter 17, that's the first presentation of all these mechanisms. When you look at chapter 18, I think it is, where you get around to reduction and Grignard reagents of these different functional groups, I strongly urge you to read about reduction and alkylation, because the rest of this, you know, I tried to scare you the first day saying we've got this many functional groups and this many reactions and this times cationic, anionic is hell. Well, as you can see, it's not quite the truth, because everything I said about acyl halides as far as alcohols or hydroxides reacting, it's all true about anhydrides as well. So you could go through the hassle of memorizing all that, or you could say it's all the same reaction over and over and over and over again. So it reduces how much worry you really have. Reduction and alkylation can change from functional group to functional group. So that's where things get more complicated, and that's where you'll have to devote a little more of your study, which is why I'm warning you ahead of time. Now, I need to leave you with a question, though, because I can tell how you yourselves are disappointed when you can't answer these questions, which is why I'm giving them to you. Another sinister way to make you study. So I'll just ask a rather bold question then. Will there be a significant difference in reaction mechanism if I do reduction of a linear amide or a cyclic one, better known as a lactam? So that gives you a very, 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 very specific reaction for you to study, and a specific application of that reaction. But with the little time I got left, let me wrap up with saponification of an amide. Part of my story about amides, the fact that they're part of proteins and all that, is to get around to emphasize that you do have to use harsher conditions to get amides to react. When you do saponification, it takes a good concentrated solution of hydroxide and a good amount of heat and time. When on Wednesday, when I have more time, I show you the acid version of this, it also requires a strong acid, a lot of time, a lot of heat. Not the simplest reaction to accomplish. And we could see that why right here. Because this is the same saponification mechanism we saw with an ester. Everything is identical. Carbonyl opens up. It collapses back down to kick one of two groups off. O minus or N minus? Which one's more favorable? What's more electronegative, nitrogen or oxygen? So which one better likes the negative charge? Oxygen is more electronegative. It is happier having the negative charge. Nitrogen, being less electronegative, does not tolerate the negative charge as well, is a much more basic compound. So we have hydroxide, which is the conjugate of something with a pKa of about 16, versus this amine that's got a conjugate of, 30-something, is it? 36? Wow. It's probably right about right. I think 30s is about where amines show up. So huge difference in basicity. So in other words, that nitrogen doesn't want to get kicked out at all. But what happens if it is? Then it's the same thing we saw in the saponification reaction. We've just made something that's not just basic, but in the parlance of last quarter, hella basic. Which means instant acid-base neutralization. So it is not favorable to saponify an amide. Why? It's less reactive. Remember that besides the nitrogen being delocalized, our other excuse for its reactivity was leaving groupability. Nitrogen negative doesn't want to leave. But, although nitrogen negative is a very poor leaving group, if and when it comes off, it instantly neutralizes the product, preventing reverse reaction. We are totally out of time. I can hear the next class clamoring at the doors. So section one, you saw me this morning. If you have other questions, office hours at 2:25 today. Section two, you got me all afternoon. You can ask me the questions there.